IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly at your service talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. The ninth divinely appointed Imam, of course, lived in an era in which the ethical and moral values of the Muslims had really begun to go downhill. Now, this ethical and moral decline of the Muslims can be attributed to the fact that they began to go farther away from the pivot and the axis of Islam. This axis of Islam, of course, being the divinely appointed imams. So throughout the eras when the divinely appointed imams were cast aside, they were not given the due position and the due authority that they deserved, well, then people started to go towards non-access individuals and they started to take the religion from them. Now, of course, when you start to take the religion from individuals that are non-access, that are non-pivotal, that are not the pillars of Islam, such as, of course, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and the divinely appointed imams, then you start to find that the Muslims began to decline when it came to a whole variety of things, but most importantly, the ethical and moral virtues that had been taught by Islam and the Quran and the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. So in one such dialogue, of course, you know, in an era where ethical and moral decline is occurring, the divinely appointed imam has to, you know, revive and bring back to life this ethical and moral value system of Islam. We find that the different imams did similar things in their eras. So, for example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he brought back and revived Islam via the du'as, these different supplications that we find that the imam did. In this situation, similarly, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he emphasized the ethical and moral system of Islam. And so in an era and in a time where honor was given to people based upon wealth, based upon social status, based upon power, you know, based upon the things that they owned or how many slaves or servants that they had, or how big of a house that, you know, they lived in, or a palace, when it came to the Abbasid Khulafa and the caliphs of the Abbasid, these things were considered to be honorable, which of course was something that was very, very far and removed from the original teachings of the Quran and the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And so here, in a conversation where the people were talking about honor and what true honor is and who is honorable, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he says that an honorable person who has all honor is one whose knowledge honors him. And so here, a very beautiful, you know, description of what honor is, who an honorable person is, in the words of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam in this dialogue, that listen, money and wealth and power and fame and fortune, you know, the size of your house or the number of your cars, you know, or your bank account or your social status or your, you know, these things do not bring about true honor to an individual. Sure, they might bring material, worldly honor, which in reality is of no value when you look at the hereafter and you look at the Almighty Allah and these kind of aspects of the universe. Here, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam in this dialogue is saying to the companions and to the people, listen, honor comes about with knowledge. And it is that knowledge that an individual has which brings them honor. Now, of course, the greatest of all knowledge is the ma'rifah and the knowledge and the awareness and, you know, knowing the Almighty Allah. The more you know the Almighty Allah, the more that knowledge helps you to become a good servant and a good abid, a good worshiper, a good, obedient servant of the Almighty Allah. And then you begin to follow the laws and the commandments of the Almighty Allah, of course, which have been sent to us and given to us via the Holy Quran and the Messenger of Allah and the divinely appointed imams. And of course, case in point, the ninth divinely appointed imam, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam, who explains to us in this beautiful conversation and dialogue what true honor is and who a real honorable person is. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam Al-Jawad salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. The Imam is appointed as the Imam even before the death of Imam Rida, of course. However, we're told that there was a problem that arose. The problem revolved around his mother. His mother was Khuzayran, or there are different names for her, right? Or Subayka. She was from the descendants of Maria Koptiya, Al-Koptiya, okay? From Sudan, somewhere along the northeast African coast. The reason this became a problem is because naturally, if an African woman was to marry a Mediterranean man, the child that would result will be of a dark complexion. This was an issue, such that Allama Majlisi, you know, explains to us in Bihar and other places that Ibn Abi Du'ad, one of the jurists of the Abbasid Empire, used to joke about Imam Al-Jawad by saying, "Hadha al-Aswad Abi Ja'far Ibn Ali." That instead of saying that this is the Imam, he says this is the black boy or the black Abi Ja'far. That they used to mock him and try to humiliate him in the court of the Abbasiyya, the Abbasid Empire. Because his mother was of Sudanese background, somewhere around the region of Sudan, north of Kenya, from this region. In fact, many of the wives of the imams and the mothers of the imams are from this region, thus leaving many of the imams to be of dark complexion, or shall we say black complexion. So historians tell us that this may have been used as a pretext to doubt the imamat of the ninth imam, salamullahi alayhi. And we see in the riwayat, in Al-Kafi, in the Manaqib of Ibn Shahrashub, in the Dalail of Ibn Rustum, in the Nawadir al-Mu'jizat of Ibn Rustum, and in many other sources that this was the case. So we don't really need a Black History Month to remember the oppression or the bias or bigotry or hatred shown towards people who look different than, let's say, the majority of the population.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in seven free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the seven free industrial and trade zones. Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc., have also been conducted.
There are seven active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zones' productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar Free Zone.
Chabahar Free Zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the third energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors.
Customs and transportation services are much better in the free zones. Also, there are better investment opportunities there. Aras Free Zone is one of the seven free zones in Iran. This zone has been very successful in industrial activities as well as agriculture.
Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large.
Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Ahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Srinagar, which is the main city of Indian-administered Kashmir, has been given a significant facelift, something that has not happened in decades. Roads are freshly finished, sidewalks fixed, cycle tracks laid, and new colorful signboards placed. All arrangements came after New Delhi-backed administration announced that it will host G20 meeting sessions in Kashmir. Now authorities say G20 meetings have come as a blessing to Srinagar's developmental projects.
We are at a very advanced stage of most of work in many of our projects. Similarly, what we are also doing is that we have started working in the double shift. So in the night also the work keeps on going. So with the same intention that this progress of the work should speed up. Now G20 came as a boon to us. It's a good opportunity for us to further speed up, and I think it has helped us in overall, pushing our work on top gear and helping us better coordinate and making sure that we complete many of these projects at a much faster pace.
The projects which were in a wait list for the past 5 years have been completed in a matter of no time. The citizens have appreciated the pace of the work but are criticizing some aspects.
For the people living in Srinagar, these projects make no sense. We wanted road widening for the ease of transport in the city center. Instead, they've shrunk the roads and broadened sidewalks. The administration is yet to make its decisions clear to the citizens. They've just made parts of Srinagar as a showpiece.
Smart city?
They have dug up the entire city and we are really fed up. There is no plan for the city. The businesses have been strongly dented. We are a tourism-based economy, but tourists are not even coming this way. So what sort of smart city planning is this? This is public money and people have not been taken on board.
India is expected to host 215 meetings at some 55 locations this year. Following India's move, Pakistan has accused India of exploiting its membership in G20 to advance its, quote, self-serving, unquote, agendas. However, India has called these decisions as internal matter. The meetings will be the first major international event held in Kashmir since Narendra Modi-led BJP government scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous special status in August 2019. The legislations divided the Muslim majority region into two federally administered territories.
The stage is all set and Srinagar is all ready to host the G20 meetings. Experts say G20 meetings in Kashmir is an opportunity for India to display the return of normalcy in the conflict-ravaged Kashmir. However, people of the region say New Delhi's good work in Kashmir must not revolve around the G20 meetings alone. It must move beyond and look for the larger good of people who have suffered for decades. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida became the first Japanese leader to visit South Korea for a bilateral summit after 12 years. Despite ongoing historical disputes, President Yoon has reached out to Tokyo with plans to possibly include Japan in its alliance with the U.S.
Washington.
Both countries are exposed to North Korea's nuclear threats and the military cooperation is needed more than ever. The Washington Declaration at the moment is an agreement between South Korea and the U.S., but we do not rule out the possibility of Japan's participation.
Japanese Prime Minister Kishida sought to reassure South Koreans over the impending release of contaminated water from the 2011 nuclear disaster. He also welcomed the opportunity for Japan to participate in a network of military alliances.
North Korea continues to carry out provocations in the region, and there is a sign that there is an attempt to change the current status by force. Based on this assessment, we agreed we have to strengthen deterrence and ability to respond to threats through Japanese-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-Japanese alliance, and the trilateral alliance.
Both supporters and detractors rallied outside the presidential compound. Many opposed President Yoon's outreach to Japan and militaristic pro-U.S. policies and question his patriotism.
Is President Yoon Suk-yeol, who is driving the Korean Peninsula towards Cold War confrontation while taking the lead in representing the interests of the United States and Japan, is he really the president of South Korea?
South Koreans have also been critical of President Yoon for creating a South Korean foundation to compensate victims of Japan's colonial rule. Improved relations between South Korea and Japan will no doubt be welcomed by the U.S., which wants to see a strengthened trilateral military alliance. And despite domestic opposition, President Yoon seems fully committed, with the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated to start later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know? Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why there are many mainstream platforms. So what the royal family stand for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises, could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Showing absolutely no remorse. These are the confessions of the man that led the Harakat al-Nizal separatist group, responsible for several terrorist operations in Iran that left over 450 casualties in a span of 15 years.
According to our plan, our members received military training. That is because we wanted to give the impression that Harakat al-Nizal is strong and can carry out military operations. We even started our activities with an attack on the governor's office inside the city in a residential area.
Based on the theory that the end justifies the means, the Swedish-backed terrorist ringleader masterminded one of the deadliest terror attacks in Iran. In 2018, the attack on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz killed at least 25 people and injured 70 others, many of which were civilian onlookers.
You could say that all of those who were killed or injured in the attacks were ordinary civilians. We really didn't care. Even many of them were Arabs, and that was okay. We just wanted everyone to know about us. We want people to know Harakat al-Nizal.
The Harakat al-Nizal terror group has been pushing to separate the southwestern province of Khuzestan, which is home to Iran's Arab population.
Arab, Turk, or Persian. We are all Iranians and we will always remain united.
I took part in this funeral to show my support for the Islamic Republic and our leader Ayatollah Khamenei. We are one and nobody can divide us.
Today I came here to send a message that we will always remain united.
Habib Farajullah Cha'ab, nicknamed Habib Osaivand, head of the terrorist group, was arrested in 2020. He stood trial in 2022, where he pleaded guilty and was convicted and sentenced to death. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence, and he was executed on May 6th. His mission remains a failed plot. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
A vigil was held in Gaza denouncing the latest Israeli crimes in Nablus, which led to the killing of three Palestinian men and a woman. Israeli occupation forces raided Nablus city on Thursday morning and assassinated three freedom fighters. Israeli army claims that the victims are responsible for the resistance operation in the Jordan Sea last month. People from all walks of life in the besieged Gaza city came out in solidarity with the West Bank against the Israeli regime's atrocities, confirming their utter support for the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank.
Those who were killed by the Israeli occupation were defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and killing them in cold blood is a war crime committed by the Zionist criminals. These crimes would only increase the Palestinian resistance actions and strengthen their unity against the occupation forces.
Al-Ghul insisted on the unity of the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza and the West Bank.
We urge the Arin al-Asud resistance group and all freedom fighters to unite. We are with you from Gaza, the 1948 occupied lands, the West Bank, and even from outside Palestinian territories in Lebanon and Syria. We are all awaiting the leader Mohammed al-Daif's commands to start battle and free Palestine.
On a separate incident, the Israeli forces murdered a Palestinian woman in Huwara town in Nablus. The assassination raised the death toll of the Palestinians to at least 102, including 20 children so far in 2023. During the vigil, people chanted slogans in defiance of the Israeli occupation and called for retaliation.
The Palestinian resistance is much more experienced against the Israeli occupation. They started with nonviolent approaches and then raised the bar for the Zionist enemy due to its brutality against the Palestinians. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank learned lessons from what happened in Gaza and are now following their footsteps. The Israelis know that the resistance is now invincible. They are certain that the resistance is able to bring them down, especially when the Netanyahu cabinet faces serious challenges in the occupied lands.
Tensions have been escalating in the West Bank in the past months. The Israeli army has intensified its operations into the Palestinian cities and towns, during which they arrested and killed tens of Palestinians. The Israeli regime commits human rights violations and war crimes on a daily basis against the Palestinian people across all Palestinian territories. And with every crime, it knows that it becomes harder to restrain the Palestinian resistance actions. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages across the 27-nation eurozone will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about $1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience, or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
According to the American media, some U.S. Republican senators and Donald Trump's former strategic allies are not sure that he can succeed in the 2024 election due to his poor personality and performance and the damage done to his image following the criminal charges against him and revelations of the Congressional Investigation Committee about the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. New York Post has covered this story and tells us more. Former Attorney General of the United States William Barr has sounded the alarm, saying Donald Trump will create chaos and a horror show if he is elected president in 2024. Speaking at an event in Cleveland, Ohio on Friday, 5th of May, former Attorney General William Barr said Donald Trump lacked the discipline to achieve the policies that he is promising. William Barr, who served as the U.S. Attorney General in the administration of former Presidents George H.W. Bush and Donald Trump, said, "If you believe in his policies, what he's advertising as his policies, he's the last person who could actually execute them and achieve them." William Barr added, "Trump does not have the discipline." He also said that Donald Trump lacked the mental capacity to set priorities or think strategically. William Barr continued, "Trump doesn't have the ability for strategic thinking or setting priorities." He described Donald Trump's conduct as what one would expect to see in a horror movie. William Barr said, "It is a horror show when he's left to his own devices. And so, you may want his policies, but Donald Trump will not deliver Trump policies." Barr noted the only goal that Donald Trump is capable of achieving through his divisive rhetoric and actions is to create division, to wreak havoc, and deliver chaos in society. William Barr added, He will deliver chaos and, if anything, lead to a backlash that will set his policies much further back than they would otherwise would be. In Trump's inaugural speech in January of 2017, he promised to end the American carnage by painting a bleak picture of a divided, dysfunctional nation that he alone could fix. Donald Trump, who is now seeking a second term in office in 2024, has been promoting himself in U.S. society as a successful leader and defender of U.S. values and a supporter of American heroes, who is himself being attacked mercilessly by those who aim to defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. He said, "We're now in the process of defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, and the looters." In the meantime, Trump has been described by some of the officials who have worked alongside him in the past as a nasty, cruel, and violent person that is even feared by most of his own party members. According to experts in sociology and psychology, Donald Trump's dangerous rhetoric provides his extreme followers with fodder to exert violence in society. Newsweek magazine has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump has hit back at William Barr after the former Attorney General of the United States predicted it would be chaos and a horror show if Trump is re-elected as president. Writing on Truth Social, Donald Trump accused William Barr of being a weak and slovenly man who didn't want anything to do with the rigged election claims. Barr resigned as Attorney General in December of 2020 after Donald Trump continued to falsely suggest that the election he lost to Joe Biden was stolen from him due to widespread voter fraud, even after William Barr publicly stated that the U.S. Justice Department had found no evidence to back up Donald Trump's claims. In response to William Barr's comments, Donald Trump attacked his one-time ally and the work he did as Attorney General and suggested he actually fired William Barr from his position in late 2020. Donald Trump wrote, "Bill Barr was a weak and slovenly man who was ill-equipped to be Attorney General because he was literally in fear of the radical left Democrats and all they were threatening to do to him. He did fine with Russia, Russia, and Russia, but it should have been gotten rid of as a made-up Democrat con job much faster." He said William Barr was most afraid of anything having to do with the rigged election because he knew that it was this subject more than any other that the Democrats did not want to even think about. Trump added, "They got away with murder, so no more discussions with the possibility of getting caught. They wanted it over. I got very tough with William Barr and pushed him hard to do his job, but he just couldn't overcome his fear of the radical left. He was useless. I nicely fired him. He's now a soundbite." This is not the first time that William Barr and Donald Trump have exchanged verbal blows. In a March 2022 interview with NBC News to promote his memoirs, William Barr described how Donald Trump showed a detachment from reality post-2020 election, including accepting a conspiracy theory that Dominion voting machines were used to rig the ballots. William Barr said he was willing to accept anything, no matter how fanciful, as long as it didn't make him a loser in the election. William Barr added that Donald Trump was the maddest I've ever seen him when he handed him his resignation letter over what then Attorney General described as incorrect election fraud claims. In response, Donald Trump said, "William Barr crumbled under pressure and bowed to the radical left, but not accepting the false election claims." Donald Trump also claimed that it is incorrect and a total fabrication that William Barr handed in his resignation and that he was the one to ask for it. American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's fellow Republicans, including even some of his strongest allies, want him to stay away from the 2024 presidential race amid his legal troubles. Senate Republicans, including members of leadership, say Donald Trump should stay out of the 2024 Senate primaries in order to avoid a repeat of last year's disappointing midterm elections. Trump, who announced his presidential campaign in November, has become the first former U.S. president to face criminal charges after a grand jury voted to indict him in New York over a hush money payment made to the film actress Stormy Daniels during the 2016 presidential election. Republican lawmakers fear he will mire the GOP candidates in debates over his pet issues such as election fraud and defunding the Department of Justice, instead of issues that matter to the American voters, such as the economy, the rate of inflation, and health care. They also worry that Donald Trump's endorsements, again, will be more driven by how the perceived candidate's loyalty to him and his agenda than on the electability in November. Senate Republican Whip John Thune said it would be better if Donald Trump stayed out of the way. Senator Lindsey Graham also said, "If I were Trump, I'd focus on my own election, but I doubt if he'll take that advice." Many GOP lawmakers believe that Donald Trump hurt Republican chances in Arizona, Georgia, and Pennsylvania by endorsing candidates from Republicans in Washington did not view as candidates with the best chance of winning the general election.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi,
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the life and works of the Muslim, Shiite personalities and ulama all across the world. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have two very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, in today's episode of the program, The Teacher, we want to talk about Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Husseini, mainly known as Mirza Shirazi or Mirza Bozorg, one of the most outstanding maraji of the 14th century Hijra, who issued the famous, we can say, tobacco sanction fatwa in Iran and Iraq and all Muslim lands. After the demise of Sheikh Murtaza Ansari, he reached the status of Marja'iyya, and for 30 years he was the Marja'a Alam, the only Marja, or the best, we can say, referred to Marja of the whole Muslim Shia lands in Iraq and Iran. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you this episode. First, give us some details about the early life and biography of Mirza Shirazi.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Husseini Shirazi, known as Mirza Shirazi, was actually the great marja of Shia in the 14th century of Hijra. He was known basically with his very famous fatwa, which was issued by him against tobacco at that time. After Sheikh Murtaza Ansari, who was another great scholar or marja, he became actually the only, we can say, marja of tashayyu for some 30 years. And that's why he is one of the greatest, we can say, scholars and maraja in the history of tashayyu. Sheikh Ansari also really loved him.
Yes.
Because he was one of the great students of him. And of course, some of the great scholars in the history of the Shayyu, like Abdul Karim Ha'iri, the founder of the Islamic Seminary of Qom, Ahund Khurasani, and Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, Mirzai Naini, Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, each one of these scholars are amongst the greatest scholars in the history of the Shayyu, we can say, in the 14th century. They were among the students of these great scholar, I mean Mirzai Shirazi.
Yes.
And Mirzai Shirazi was also the founder of Islamic Seminary of Samarra.
Yes.
Even we have a kind of a school of Samarra or a school of thought of Samarra, which was founded by this great scholar. And one of the main objectives of founding or establishing this Hawza of Samarra was this, that he wanted to actually to bring a kind of reconciliation, we can say, between Shia and Sunni in that area, to make kind of comparison studies, comparative studies, and also to make kind of friendly kind of relationship between Shiite and Sunnite in the city of Samarra, not only in the city of Samarra as a whole, kind of for all Muslims in the whole Islamic world, to bring a kind of, let's say, peaceful relationship, or we can say friendly kind of relationship between Shia and Sunni.
Okay.
It was one of the main objectives of him.
That's right.
By founding and establishing the Islamic Seminary of Samarra.
That's right.
We know that in the city of Samarra, mostly the Sunni brethren are living,
yes,
even
yes.
nowadays. So that's why founding this Hawza in the city of Samarra would help both
Sunni
and
kind of
Shia.
Action,
exactly,
you
yes,
say
yes,
to, yes.
Yeah, of course.
To make them closer
it
to each other.
It would help both Shia and Sunni people to get more familiar with each other, to find out those commonalities or common areas between these two, let's say, Islamic denominations.
That's all right. One of the most outstanding fatwas of the maybe contemporary era of the whole Islamic lands is the tobacco movement, or the fatwa against the tobacco use in Iran and in Iraq by Ayatollah Shirazi, Mirzai Shirazi. What was exactly the story, Sayyid Mohsen Nawawi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as our dear guest has said, that Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Shirazi was the student of Sheikh Ansari.
Yes.
And when we look at his life, we see that he was politically very famous personality, because he became the sole marja of the Shia. Basically, his status amongst the Shia was a big status. And we can see, like, after the death of Sheikh Ansari, basically there was a group of people from Azerbaijan who announced Ayatollah Kukamari as the marja for themselves. But Kukamari also passed away in the life of Sayyid Shirazi, Muhammad Hassan Shirazi.
Yes.
And then he became the only, we can say, marja. And in other words, we can say, like, a faqih who is ruling the whole Shia society. At that time, we can see that England was invading different countries.
Yes.
And East India Company, who went to subcontinent first, and with the, you know, they went for the trading, and later, you know, they invaded, they took over the whole land, in the subcontinent land. Similarly, they planned to come to Iran and Iraq as well. And East India Company wanted to basically open a factory of a tobacco. And the reason was they just said, like, we want to open the trade between the Iran and the England, and then we want to have this tobacco factory. Now, this news came to Ayatollah Shirazi, and when this news came to him, he analyzed everything, that wherever East India Company goes, and the English, we can say, like, rulers, whenever they are there, they're not for the purpose of trading only. Rather, they want to invade, they want to get our people involved, and they want to control the economics of a country, you know, the economical system. Therefore, he gave a fatwa against it. And he said that it is haram for everyone. It is prohibited for everyone in Iran and Iraq to smoke or use the tobacco. Now, this fatwa, basically, this was a big bomb for the British government and the East India Company.
Yes.
Because at that time, even the ruler of Iran, when he wanted, after the fatwa, his tobacco, like, you know, the smoking he wanted to smoke, his wife, basically, stopped him from smoking. And he got angry. They said, like, he got angry. And he said, when a king is saying to you to bring the tobacco or the smoke or, like, you know, the tobacco, why you're not bringing? And she replied that the one who made us halal, which explains that the alama or faqih who basically made us halal on each other,
yes,
he has said it is haram to smoke. And that was the case, that from there onwards, no one smoked until the East India Company, they packed everything and then they went back. And when they went back, he took back his fatwa.
Yes.
So basically it was one of the ways of fighting with the invaders, with the oppressors, with the tyrannical powers.
That's right.
So this was one of the things. On the other hand, we can see, like, he was very much socially and politically involved in the society where, you know, when the Shias were being killed, the Hazara Shias in Afghanistan.
Yes, yes.
By Abdurrahman. He sent a telegraph to the government of England. Why? Because the Britain was ruling at this area at that time, to stop this genocide, Shia genocide. And on the other hand, you know, the unity between Shia and Sunni.
Yes.
He was the one who opened and made different markets.
That's right.
In different areas of Iraq, so that people's economical situation can become better. Making Husseiniyah for Imam Hussein, like for the those who mourn for Imam Hussein, the Zahir Saradi, the we can say the hotels of that time, like where the Zahirin or the those who come to pilgrimage.
Some public facilities were made by the team. That's right. Okay, it's good. That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Mostly Mirza Shirazi is known as the reviver of the, we can say, the power of fatwa. Shaykh Rouhani, I think this would be very much interesting for our dear listeners, that how, for example, a Shaykh or a Sayyid or a Marja felt responsible to issue a fatwa, but in the, for example, the economic situation or political situation, how do you find his role in this case?
You know, actually, from the Shiite perspective, the successor of the Prophet, like the infallible Imams, they have the same responsibilities of the Prophet, except for this, that they will not receive any revelation.
Yes.
When it comes to the maraja, you know, the religious leaders in Tashayyu, they also have, like, the same responsibilities of the imams. When imam protect the people against the invaders, against the occupiers or oppressors, the same responsibility goes to the ulama, to the maraji, because they have this responsibility to protect the people, to protect Islam, to protect the Muslims against the invaders. That's why we see that in the life of this great scholar, Ayatollah Shirazi, we see that how much influential was his fatwa.
Yes.
That even in, as our guest, respected guest said, that even inside the house of the king, the children of the king, the wife of the king did not obey the king and said that because this Ayatollah or this Marja issued this fatwa, we do not even obey you as a king. So it was, it shows that how much important, how much effective is the role of a Marja-i Taqlid to protect the people. I think if you go back to the history, we see that the great Shiite scholars played their role in the most perfect way, because they really protected the people of Iraq, people of Iran, the Shiite people and Muslims against this kind of invasion. Look, for example, when you go to Africa, when you go to like South America, Australia, see what happened to those people. You know, we see that in some of those areas, even the local people, the original people were eliminated completely.
Mm-hmm.
They were killed.
Yes.
Now there's no sign of any of any sign of those original people.
Mm-hmm.
But they protected Middle East. They protected the people of Iraq. They protected the people of Iran. The same policy that Britishers had for the African people, for the South American people, they had the same plans for Muslims. But it was the role of Maharaja. It was the role of, you see, as you see, he sent a telegraph to the British queen not to commit genocide against the Shiite community in Afghanistan.
So that's how much
important was it. So that's why even nowadays, still this role is important. And if Maharaja fulfilled this responsibility against the invaders, against the oppressors, they would protect Muslims in the best way against this kind of oppression or, let's say, invasion.
And in order to show his seriousness in his fatwa, he says that using tobacco and we can say, or something related to tobacco, cigarette or something like that, from today on is as if you are fighting with Imam Zaman, okay? With Imam Mahdi, to show that how much serious is he in his fatwa against the British powers, the French powers, the foreign powers on it all, having control over the tobacco. And we know that, for example, Nasiruddin Shah at that time was the king of Iran, so he signed all these contracts. In a way, he was selling the country to different foreign powers, you know, through his contracts. And after that, he has to get back to the right track. I mean, in the Islam and the Islamic lands by the answer of Mirza Shirazi. All in all, we could see that most of his public affairs are still remembered. The reviving of Hawza Samarra is very much remembered, his fatwa against tobacco use and his struggles for the whole Shiite world and the Muslim lands, the letters that he sent to different leaders of the countries in order to defend the rights of the Muslims are really outstanding. At the age of 82, he passed away in the city of Samarra, but his body was taken to the Holy Shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the city of Najaf. And so many outstanding other works, we can say so many treaties, so many un-Islamic laws were also produced by this outstanding man, Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Hosseini, mainly known as Mirza Shirazi. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Shaykh Rouhani for a nice elaboration on his life. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.